Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. My name is Boris Chassaigne. I'll be with you for the next half hour. On today's Viewpoints, the Western Literacy Council has a new executive director, Craig Graham, just loves his new job.
If you're lacking in literacy skills, that can hold you back. So sometimes we're the first door that people go to. We're just about opening doors and allowing people to participate more in society.
The small Cortes Island Market celebrates its 30 years on the island. Keeping customers happy seems to be the best recipe.
I just love everything about the job. I love serving people. I love making people happy. And I love the gratitude that's shown to me by doing this for other people. Like, my motto is to do something special for one person every day.
We stay on Cortes, where Hugh Barton believes he has the largest native Western yew on the island. He explains how he found the tree.
I said, oh, we're buying this property. Oh, cool. You know, so we all shake hands and go, because you have to see this yew tree. Look what you, it's on your property. So then I discovered this and I went, wow, there's not very many that are that big.
And in Quebec, the Pontiac region is doing more to attract the healthcare workers it lost.
Please come back. We need you now more than ever. We want you, we need you, we value you, and we respect you.
This and more on Viewpoints.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
The Western Quebec Literacy Council has a new executive director. Greg Graham will handle the day-to-day operations of the council. The nonprofit organization provides educational assistance for English-speaking Quebecers, not only for language, but also numeracy and computer skills, among other things. Graham, who already has served in many roles in Pontiac's educational sector, said that he knew a lot of people involved in the organization before he applied and called them movers and shakers in the community, people who have done a lot of good. He's with our journalist Caleb Nickerson.
Okay, so we're joined here by the newly appointed executive director of the Western Quebec Literacy Council, Greg Graham. Greg, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Oh, not so bad. So you explain a little bit the process of how you gained this new role.
Well, like anybody else, I saw the posting, I heard about it, and I applied. And then I had the great pleasure of meeting everybody from the board, and I knew a lot of them, knew that they were some real movers and shakers in the community, you know, people who've done a lot of good and gotten involved. And I knew about the reputation of the Literacy Council and the good work they do, and I thought, you know, I'd like to be a part of that. That's somewhere where I think I can help out. So, that's kind of how it came about.
Interesting. And for those of you that don't know, you might want to explain to them how involved you are in other sort of education groups and just other community groups in general here in the Pontiac.
Sure. Well, like most Pontiacers, I'm involved in about 15 different things, you know. But I'm on the, you know, the Municipal Council for Bristol and have been for many years. And I'm the school board commissioner for the Western Quebec School Board for the Clarendon, Bristol, Shawville, Otter Lake area. I'm the president of the Pontiac Community Players. I've been involved in different things. I've been involved with Heritage College here in Campbell's Bay for a long time. I'm really starting to get a feel for all the very cool and interesting things going on in the Pontiac and being able to identify places where maybe I can help out a little.
And so can you describe what your new role here, what exactly does that entail?
Well, you know, I'm responsible for the day-to-day management and running of the Literacy Council. So if you're not familiar with the West Quebec Literacy Council, we've been around for a long time, since the 80s. And across the entire region, so, you know, Hull, Elmer, you know, from Buckingham up to Chapeau, up to the Swishaw, all the way up the Gatineau Valley to Maniwaki, we're involved with giving people literacy skills, helping adults primarily, but we have some other programs like Reading Buddies, which has been very popular in the elementary schools. But primarily for adults, we've been helping them gain reading and writing skills, but also numeracy skills, you know, math skills, and also increasingly over the years, computer skills, so that people can participate in society, you know, so that people don't have anything holding them back from what they want to do. You know, we've got a lot of great programs in the Pontiac, adult education, post-secondary programs that people can take. But if you're lacking in literacy skills, that can hold you back. So sometimes we're the first door that people go to, you know, or seniors who are having trouble with some of the app-based world we're living in, then, you know, all the things they need to access. These programs have been very helpful there as well. So we're just about opening doors and allowing people to participate more in society.
And is this exclusively for Anglophones or English speakers here?
Yeah, that's our primary focus. Although, I mean, if a Francophone shows up, we direct them to an organization that could help them in particular.
Mm-hmm.
But our specific focus is to the English-speaking population, yes.
And so how many, clients would you say? Is that the term that you guys have?
Yeah, clients, students, participants, whatever you want to say. Over the years, we've had many, many, many. I mean, it differs depending on the time of year. And these last couple of years with COVID, it's been very challenging because, like everyone, we've had to move to virtual sessions, and that's made things a little bit difficult. But we have a core team of tutors, and we have tutor training regularly where people can volunteer to help become a tutor so that they can share what they know and work with people one-on-one to give them those skills. And it's very rewarding for them. You know, we've got a lot of retired teachers, a lot of retired people who volunteer as tutors. We have people working in all sorts of different industries who volunteer, and people coming out, you know, for all sorts of different reasons. You know, I'd say over the years, we've helped a lot of people, and everything from, you know, the most basic literacy skill gaining to even more complex things.
And so just jumping off of that, I know you haven't been on the job for too long just yet, but are there any priorities that you're dealing with right now? Are you looking for volunteers? Are you looking to start up certain programs? What's on your radar right now?
Well, right now, like everyone, we're coming out of COVID, you know, so we're doing our strategic planning right now with the board and with our employees and and eventually talking to all of our volunteers who work with us and all the members. And we're looking at, well, how do we want to approach this? You know, how can we fulfill our core function of helping out the people of the Pontiac?
Greg, I want to thank you for your time here. If there's anything that we didn't touch on here, you can feel free to have the last word here.
Just want to say thank you to everyone for, you know, being excited to have me in this role. I'm excited to be in the role too, and I can't wait to work with all our different community partners and all the different organizations and all the different communities and people of the Pontiac to make good things happen. You know, as I always like to say, you can't play a game if not everybody, you know, you can't have a hockey game if some people aren't actually out on the ice. Everybody's got to participate. It does good for everyone if everyone participates. And that's what literacy is all about, just making sure everybody can participate in all the good things going on.
I'm Pamela Hassan in Smithers, British Columbia. You are listening to Viewpoints.
Continuing care assistants across Nova Scotia are getting a significant raise. Premier Tim Houston recently announced that the province will spend $65 million to increase the salaries of all publicly funded continuing care assistants by 23%. Ed Halverson prepared this for us.
Houston hopes raising wages to near the highest levels in the country will entice people to return to the field.
To those of you who have felt undervalued to the point that you left the profession, please come back. We need you now more than ever. We want you, we need you, we value you, and we respect you.
Executive Director with Queens County Home Support, Annette Hartland, says their organization has lost approximately 25% of their staff during the pandemic.
Prior to the pandemic, we had between 60 and 70. Unfortunately, with the pandemic, we're down now to about 45. But we're hoping, of course, with this increase, because staffing has been a huge challenge, like I say, not only for us, but for many other providers of home support services and in long-term care, we're hoping that this will entice more people into the profession.
Hartland says having fewer workers to cover the same number of clients puts a higher burden on the remaining CCAs, and many people burn out.
I worry about them because they're working 40, 50 hours, 60 hours a week, trying to get as many client visits in as they can and many needs met. I admire them for what they're doing, and I'm hoping we'll soon be able to give them a reprieve.
Hartland says the representatives from across her profession have been meeting with government about the need to address their challenges, and it seems the message is getting through.
I mean, yes, the money is great, and it goes a long way of helping our CCAs, but I think it's the government's recognition of their value that is more important.
The pay raise goes into effect February 10th. I'm Ed Halverson.
Hugh Barton lives on Cortes Island off the BC coast. He arrived on the island decades ago, and shortly after buying his property, this local carpenter found what might be the largest Western yew on Cortes Island. Western yew has short, flat needles similar to hemlock. It is unusual as it's the only conifer that produces berries. Barton doesn't know how old the tree is, but it appears to be more than 10 feet around the trunk and close to 400 years old. You should check out the photo of the tree we have posted on canada-info.ca. The tree found likely avoided the first round of logging on Cortes Island in the early 1900s. Fortunately, the Western yew does not produce what is considered to be good timber. Barton believes indigenous people used the strong wood for making items such as bows, tools, paddles, and prying sticks. It is still used today for carving and making bows and paddles. The tree was overexploited in the 1900s after the bark was found to contain the anti-carcinogen compound Taxol, used to make the drug tamoxifen, which is now produced chemically. Barton occasionally collects limbs that have fallen from several large yew trees on his property to use in carpentry projects. He is excited that he continues to discover younger yews there, where growing conditions appear to be ideal for the tree. Kate Madigan met with Hugh Barton. He talks about how he found the tree.
And yeah, see, he's got one, two, three, four. There's four more right over there, and I've got three right here. So there's seven. There's seven big yew trees here.
So when did you finally figure out that these were yews, though?
The first hike Kathy and I did, we walked to this corner. We could hear people talking, and Volker was over there. So I says, hi, and they said, hi. So they come wandering over, and I said, oh, we're buying this property. Oh, cool. You know, so we all shake hands, and Volker says, you have to see this yew tree. Look what yew, it's on your property. Because I've always loved yew wood. I mean, you know, the Charlottes, I did a bunch of carving up there and stuff. So then I discovered this, and I went, whoa.
The yew stands at more than 10 feet around at its base. I've never seen a yew tree that big before.
There's not very many that are that big.
I don't know anything about yews.
Well, this is, I think it's Taxus brevolia, which is not European yew, it's Western yew. And it's used it, indigenous people used it for all kinds of things. It's one of the hardest woods around. They used it for spears and tools. And it also bends quite nicely, makes nice ribs for boats, if you can get a nice straight piece. And of course, European yew, they made bows out of it. And they do that here too, with some success. Some of them are pretty decent, but hard to get much straight wood out of it. You know, you'll get 6-8, you're lucky if you ever get 10 feet.
The Western yew is a conifer native to BC. Its needles are short and flat, and the Western yew is the only conifer with berries. All other conifers have cones. The berries are red and poisonous. The Western yew has been used heavily by past and present humans. When an anti-cancer property called Taxol was discovered in its bark, the tree was harvested heavily in the 1990s. Today's forestry practices have neglected the tree and put the tree at risk.
I mean, is this second growth, though? I mean, like, did they just spare these?
Yeah. Well, for one thing, the yew tree is what they call non-merchantable timber, so they don't harvest it, which is a shame because there's tons of it lying out in the bush. Sometimes loggers pick it up if it's close to the road. They usually just pick it up in like 4 or 5 or 6 foot sections and carry it and throw it in the truck and burn it or sell it to guys like me that mill it up and we use it. But as a rule, it's just left in the bush.
They cut it and they leave it.
Yeah. These were spared, but I mean, this tree right here is not a young tree. So there is some trees around here that were spared, and I'm not sure why.
Most native yew trees around the island are quite sparse, small, and easily passed for hemlock to the untrained eye. Others have been seen in the Carrington and Green Valley forested areas on Cortez Island.
And we stay on Cortez Island. The Cortez Market in Mansions Landing opened its doors in 1991. It has been in business for more than 30 years under one owner, Bertha Jeffrey. She says the key to small business survival is catering to the needs of customers. The island is served by 3 general stores, which also managed to survive, due in part to a 3-fold increase in the island's population during summer months as family, friends, and tourists visit. Jeffrey enjoys coming to work every day, and after 31 years at the helm, she has no plans to retire. She loves her job. Her business features everything from groceries to hardware, alcohol and lottery tickets to gardening and kitchen supplies. She's the longest serving store owner on Cortez Island and says that her customers keep her inspired. She adds that doing something special for someone every day is her motto. Greg Osoba met with Mrs. Jeffrey.
Of the 3 general stores on the island, it's the only one that has been run by the owner who started the business. Bertha Jeffrey says it's the customers who keep her inspired to keep coming to work every day.
I think the thing that really works is trying to keep the customers happy, getting in what they want and just being consistent and keeping the hours we post and that sort of thing. I think that really helps.
And can you give us just a sort of a range of what kind of products you offer? Because you've got quite a wide scope of stuff available here.
It is a wide range. For the most part, groceries is our main sales. Milk, dairy, fresh meat. We also have hardware. We have liquor. We have cigarettes. And we have lottery tickets. We have a deli area that people often get their lunches and dinners from. And I think there's all sorts of other little things, but it's pretty well grouped into that.
Yeah, I was thinking, where else can you go on Cortez Island? Get a fresh meat sandwich, pick up your bottle of wine for dinner, get those nails you need for the building project, and then pick up a few kitchen items, like maybe a baking pan or something like that. So it's really sort of a one-stop shop.
Yeah, we try. I mean, we're not a box store, obviously, but we have a little bit of a lot of things.
And what inspires you to keep coming to work every day?
I love my job. I have to admit that I love it. I should be retiring, but I don't have a lot of interests outside of the store. I love the social aspect. I love the fact that I can shop every day. And that's basically why I'm here. Like, I just love everything about the job. I love serving people. I love making people happy. And I love the gratitude that's shown to me by doing this for other people. Like, my motto is to do something special for one person every day. So maybe it's cashing their check. Maybe it's bringing in a product for them, whatever. But I try really hard to do something special every day for someone.
You know, something that I recognize that I think is a tremendous service that you've done for so many people over the years, whether they be newcomers or people down on their luck, is you've extended credit to people. How important is that to you?
Again, like, that is one of the areas that is, when I first started the store, all the stores had credit. And so it wasn't anything different. Like, they've all been extending credit and stuff. Over the years, that's not as, I don't know if the other stores do it or not. I mean, we keep on doing it for our good customers. It's good to help out somebody when their check doesn't come in and they can't feed their kids. They can come and get enough groceries for a couple days. Before, there was no bank. There was no way to get funds over here. There wasn't a bank machine. There wasn't Interact, you know. It was just a way of life. They charged for the month and then they'd pay it off, right? Everything's totally changed now with credit cards and debit cards. And, you know, there's no longer the risk involved with debit cards that there was with checks. And so it, for the most part, I think a lot of people like it and depend on it. So I carry it on like it's something that I can do. We've been stung a few times, but most people are very honest on Cortez.
One thing I can attest to, Bertha, is that both my stepdaughters, I believe, had their first jobs with you.
Yes,
and so you like to support the young people in getting started in the business world.
Yes, I do. I enjoy having young people around me. It keeps me young. But I really do enjoy even the staff that's here. I like hiring people from the island first that have a vested interest in the island and that want to live here. And so, you know, I would much rather hire somebody like that than go to Camworth for a job, find and bring somebody over here and take away a job. That for people that are living over here, right? I prefer to support the residents.
What advice would you give to somebody just wanting to start out opening a retail business?
I think the most important part is you have to work. A lot of people think opening up a business is just hiring people to do all the work and you just sit back and take the glory. You can't. You have to be hands-on. You have to have your finger in everything. And it's not easy. Like it really takes a lot of work to keep all the different sections together. You supply a service for people that want to buy it, and you'll do fine as long as you, you know, keep your appointments, do whatever for your business. As soon as it starts being, well, you just do it when it's convenient for you, it just falls down.
Well, Bertha, best of luck for another 30 years.
I hope so.
Yeah.
And, that's kind of pushing it, though.
Congratulations and thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Greg Osoba, Cortez Island.
You're on the air with Viewpoints. Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI.
The Tantramar infrastructures and coastal regions in New Brunswick are regularly impacted by the effects of climate change. So are the Tantramar salt marshes on the Isthmus of Chignecht near Sackville around the Bay of Fundy. One of the big climate-related concerns in the Tantramar region is flood risk and how we can adapt infrastructure to meet the increased risk coming from sea level rise and increased frequency of extreme weather. For coastal geomorphologist Danica von Prujdi, the problem isn't just one of adaptation to lower the risk, but how it can be done while helping mitigate climate change overall. Von Prujdi works in nature-based solutions to create resiliency or protection from things like flooding. She says nature-based solutions have value in addition to the protections they provide. Mrs. Von Prujdi's work focuses on coastal flood risk, and one of her key tools is the Tantramar's claim to fame, saltwater marsh. They provide all sorts of benefits, such as carbon sequestration, decreasing greenhouse gas emissions. They provide habitat, lots of biodiversity, options for recreation, culture, and mental well-being as well, she says. Erica Butler spoke with Mrs. Van Prujdi about how the marsh works to reduce flood risk, how she and her team are working to regrow marshes, and how nature-based solutions can figure into the future protections of the Chignecto Isthmus.
What we're trying to do is we're trying to leverage some of the natural resilience, so the capacity of our natural systems, if they are in a healthy state, to be able to withstand stressors such as sea level rise, storm impacts, and other climate change impacts. So what we try to do is we try to make use of the fact that salt marshes and the plants that are in there are able to slow down waves and decrease wave heights just through the natural motion of water moving through the vegetation itself. And it's been shown and documented through a lot of evidence, both in the lab and in the field, that we only need a relatively narrow strip of a healthy marsh and water to move over it, that we can actually reduce the height of those waves and the energy in that wave quite significantly.
Mm-hmm. It almost works as a sort of buffer.
Absolutely. And that's why we've been working a lot with the province in particular to help increase the health of the foreshore marsh and learn and understand how much of that buffer do we actually need. Many of the dikes within the Bay of Fundy do still have some foreshore marsh that are there, and we're trying to help them either grow new foreshore marsh or make the ones that are there more resilient. And in areas of Europe, for example, the foreshore marsh is actually completely integrated into the engineering design of those structures. And so by having a wide marsh platform in front, they're actually reducing the height of the dikes that are needed to provide equivalent protection for the communities that are behind them.
Have you actually been like moving dikes and creating spaces for these foreshore marshes to regrow or reestablish themselves?
So we've been working with Sibiu Wetlands Environmental Specialists and the province over the last almost 15 years now to restore about 400 hectares of tidal wetlands within the province. But specifically in the most recent years, we have been fortunate to have a series of managed realignment sites that were funded through the DFO Coastal Restoration Fund. And two of those sites are in the Upper Bay of Fundy. One is in the Chignecto Isthmus, which is called Converse. In those areas, what we do is we work with very closely with the Department of Agriculture on land. These lands are ones that are underutilized, perhaps poorly, not draining very, very well. And we worked with them to come up with a design to reintroduce tidal waters into those sites. So that involves removing abattoir, the tide gate structures, as well as leveling parts of the dike and building a new inner dike to protect the lands.
Now, when you say the province, you're referring to the province of Nova Scotia, right?
Yes, I'm referring to the province of Nova Scotia. However, the province of New Brunswick has also undertaken some projects as well. And one of them, for example, would be, it's actually a Ducks Unlimited site at Olac, New Brunswick, and that was done in partnership as well with the province of New Brunswick.
Okay. All right. So both provinces are active on this. All eyes are really on the Chignecto Isthmus because people are concerned. It's a transportation corridor. What do you think when you look at that whole isthmus and the importance of the infrastructure there and the risk that it's at, what do you think the potential is for nature-based solutions to play a role in how we protect that in the future?
I think they absolutely can play a role. I do believe, however, for that corridor, because of the significance of the infrastructure, it will be very much it's essential that it's a planned combined approach involving multiple disciplines, multiple departments in order to make those informed decisions and considering the system as a whole, not just the CN Rail and the Trans-Canada Highway through that area. And so there will be definite need in some areas for more harder infrastructure for some of the infrastructure areas, but there's a lot of area and opportunity to then decrease the vulnerability of the new infrastructure to climate change impacts by well-planned, modeled, and nature-based solutions within that area.
That's coastal geomorphologist Danica Van Prujdi. Though she did participate in a stakeholder session at the beginning of the process that produced the long-awaited Chignecto Isthmus report, and her team has sent information to the report writers, Van Prujdi says she was not formally invited to the discussions around the Isthmus report. You can check out two of the sites that Van Prujdi has been involved in nearby to the Tantramar area. The Converse site is just across the Missaguash River in Nova Scotia, and there's also a site at Aulac, done in partnership with Ducks Unlimited. I'm Erica Butler.
So this ends this edition of Viewpoints, a program produced by the Local Journalism Initiative and presented by the Community Radio Fund of Canada in collaboration with campus and community radios across the country. You can listen to all our programs on canada-info.ca. That's canada-info.ca. Also, tune in to all the stories produced by our journalists working across the country in British Columbia, Ontario, Quebec, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, and elsewhere. That's on canada-info.ca. Their radio pieces are posted there on a daily basis. They allow us to discover Canada and our local communities from a different perspective. Thanks to our journalists Caleb Nickerson, Ed Alverson, Pamela Hassan, Erica Butler, Craig Osoba, and their guest, and also to Maureen McEwen, our national coordinator. Stay tuned to your radio station. I'm Boris Chassagne. Thanks for being with us.